I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have today. But Emmy, did you want to go through a brief overview of the Academy before I call up your presentation materials?
Sure. Thank you, Jean. So for everyone who's joining us today, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Federal Facilities Academy. It is a voluntary training program developed for EPA's remedial project managers, as well as project managers from other federal agencies, state and local government, and tribal groups who work on federal facility cleanups at Superfund sites. So we have 11 webinars that are part of our 2024 offerings listed here. They're all open and available for registration, so you can check them out at the website provided. And then there's also an in-person 3-day course. I say in person, occasionally we offer it virtually as well. Should you complete all 12 courses, you can receive a certificate of completion from our director of the Federal Facilities Superfund program. And I'll let Jean explain how to show that you've received credit for each of these.
All right. Thank you, Emmy. So let me go ahead and take us forward. This is one of the most common questions that I get is how do you get credit? So as Emmy, there's a series of webinars that'll be held online and then a classroom delivery to a limited audience. For the online webinars, for those 11 classes that we'll be hosting here through Kluent, you can participate in any of them live online or replay the recorded versions of any of those sessions. For the in-person classroom training, the only way you can receive credit is to attend that one in person if you're part of the limited audience, such as EPA, states, tribes, and other federal agencies. Now, for each one of the Kluent webinars, whether you attend it live or replay it, you can receive an individual certificate for each one of those sessions. We'll talk about how to get that credit at the end of each delivery, but essentially, you'll share feedback, check a box when you submit your feedback, and then you'll immediately have access to a certificate for any of the 11 webinars that you attend live or replay online. And then, as Emmy highlighted, if you're able to complete all of those webinars, either all online, all archived, or some combination of live and archived, and you also qualify and can attend the in-person delivery, then you can receive that Academy certificate that recognizes your involvement in all parts of this series. So I think that's the end of that summary. And Emmy, if it's okay, I'm going to go ahead and call up the presentation materials. And I think it's about time to get started. So I'm going to turn the floor over to you.
All right, thank you so much. So we're ready to start our first offering of our 2024 webinars, which is on determining land use and on-site off-site determinations. My name is Emmy Laiha. I am the Deputy Director of our Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office here at EPA headquarters. And we have some other instructors joining us. I'll allow them to introduce themselves when it's their turn to speak. So we'll just start with a course overview. We have three different sections we'll be covering. The first one will be on land use and EPA guidance on how to determine land use. We'll transition to site reuse, talking about beneficial reuse and reuse assessments, specifically guidance on those topics. And then we'll finish out with our on-site, off-site determinations. That'll touch on the role of permit requirements and the off-site role. So let's go ahead and jump into it. When it comes to determining land use, there are a number of things that need to be considered, right? Those land use assumptions that are being made are going to identify what exposure pathways are considered. How are they evaluated for current risk assessments and future potential threats? So if you're looking at a recreational land use in the future post cleanup, what kind of exposures do you have to look at? Are people on the site for so many hours per day. We have young children, pregnant mothers, who are the most vulnerable populations that might be using that land. So recreational scenarios are going to be different from agricultural ones, where you might be more particularly interested in that exposure pathway of water percolating through the soil and particularly being picked up by vegetation versus industrial and residential. So all of those are important to know in the beginning, because our remedial action objectives, goals for cleanup will be dependent on those land use assumptions. So it is very much something that has to be considered throughout the cleanup process. So before we get into too much more lecturing, we have a few polls for interaction. And Jean, will you take us through these?
Absolutely. So, Emmy, I'm going to go ahead and call up our first poll. There should be a new pop-up window that is on the screen for the audience asking a question. When selecting a CERCLA remedy at a federal facility, who determines the reasonably anticipated land use? Is it A, EPA, B, the lead cleanup agency, C, the state, D, the public, or E, all of the above? So I'll have you read through those responses and then simply click the circle to the left of the response that you think is correct and then press the submit button. If you don't see the pop-up poll, look under a three dots or more menu. You may see it buried there. And of course, if you don't see the poll window actually displaying, that's okay. You can share your responses by sending a message into the Q&A. And as I'm looking, it looks like about 60% of the audience have shared their responses. And I promise you, we won't be grading you. So it's okay. Take your best guess and submit those answers in. And I think I'll go ahead and close the poll down here in 3, 2, 1. And let's take a look. All right, Emmy, we've got a bit of a distribution. Although 60% of the audience picked E, all of the above, a pretty significant portion of them thought perhaps it was the lead cleanup agency or even EPA. What's the right answer?
So the right answer is that no single party or group should be determining land use on their own. It really is a discussion that needs to happen between your regulatory agencies, the lead cleanup agency, and interactions with local state governments, the public, on what the anticipated land use or reasonably anticipated land use may be for that area. Especially if you have sites that are located near cities or growing populations, there is likely going to be more public interest in those types of situations. Or if you have an area around a Superfund site that's been identified as a monument or wilderness area, again, recreational activities there are going to be of interest to the public. So we'll talk more about the guidance that lays out which parties should be part of that conversation, but no, it's not just a single group or agency's decision on what that will be.
All right, we have another poll. So I'm going to go ahead and launch our next question here. And this time, the new poll window should be asking a second question. Can the land use determination at a federal facility change? You'll have three choices: A, yes, B, no, or C, never. Again, same instructions. Click the circle to the left of the answer that you think is correct and then hit that submit button. Now, in this case, almost 70% of you have voted, and the audience is pretty consistent that I can see in the answer that they are picking right now. So I think I'm going to close this one down since we've got group consensus here in 3, 2, 1, and let's share those results. So almost everyone said A. Yes, it can change. What's the right answer?
Yes, definitely yes, it can change. And in the event that the land use does change, say it was anticipated to be a recreational area, but now years later they're looking at developing it for residential purposes or commercial purposes. If that land use changes, then it's important to go back and evaluate all the implications that may have. For example, what was the selected remedy? Is that remedy still protective given there are different exposure pathways that need to be considered with this updated land use. So looking back at the protectiveness of the remedy and how that's going to impact the land use long term is very important. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in this webinar. We'll go ahead and continue on to our next slide here with continuing on land use determinations. So again, I mentioned already that it's important to the process, the cleanup process, because how you're going to use the land after cleanup is going to help determine what your cleanup goals are, those remedial action objectives. That in turn is going to affect the technologies that are considered and all the remedy components that are considered, ultimately impacting the selected remedy. So having that land use discussion up front is very important to the process. And no, it's not just the lead agency or regulatory agencies to make this decision, but often community involvement has a critical role in having those discussions with the community on what is reasonable for that land use looking into the future. And note that these discussions, these agreements, should all be documented in the administrative record. Often some sites will have a land use plan that can be referenced. Hopefully, that's not just issued by one agency unilaterally, but actually reflects a group process where regulatory agencies, other interested parties are involved in the conversation. But again, that should be in your administrative record. So there's a way to track what conversation was had and the decisions that came from that. A few things I want to highlight for the group are key pieces of EPA guidance that are handy to have PDFs downloaded on your computer for easy reference. The top three for land use, I would say, is the 1995 Land Use and the CERCLA Remedy Selection Process Guidance. And keep in mind that there should be links to all of these popping up in the chat, as well as on the web page that has all the course resources. Also, there's the 2001 Reuse Assessments, a tool to implement the Superfund Land Use Directive, also very helpful. And lastly, the Considering Reasonably Anticipated Future Land Use and Reducing Barriers to Reuse at EPA-led Superfund remedial sites. Granted that it specifically says EPA-led, but the information in there is still very helpful at federal facility sites as well. A lot of information you can consider. So let's go ahead and start with the first land use directive of guidance. That's from 1995. So yes, it's been a few years, but we still point to this guidance and the important information that it has. So it lays out having discussions with local land use planning authorities, local officials, and the public really should be conducted as early as possible during the initial scoping phase of the Remedial Investigation and Feasibility Study, or the RIFS. For federal facility sites, the unique part is that many of our sites may have been placed on the national priorities list 10, 20 years ago. So cleanup has been in process for a long time. These conversations might have taken place 20 plus years ago. For some of our newer, I think we've added like six federal facility sites to the national priorities list in the last couple of years. Ideally, when those processes are just starting, then you can have that conversation. But again, the point here is having that discussion very early in the process, be it by having public meetings or other workshops, other types of events where you can speak with community members should be conducted, and that information taken and considered when looking at land use. Other things you might consider are zoning laws or public population growth patterns, what's going on with the natural resources in that area, in the need for institutional controls. All of that should be considered in those discussions early on. And then, as I had already mentioned, whatever considerations of anticipated future land use are made, that should be documented in the administrative record. Because 10, 20 years later, who's going to be around that still remembers that discussion? There might be a few people, because we do have long timers on some of our cleanups, but having that record is really, really important. The directive also says that informed future land use assumptions are going to help with the baseline risk assessment and feasibility study. So it's focusing on developing practicable, oh, that word always gets me, and cost-effective remedial alternatives. That's also going to help with the available land use types following completion of the remedial action. So you know your cleanup is going to support the plan, the vision for the site long term after cleanup, because we want to complete cleanup at our federal facility sites. One cool example we wanted to share with you all was the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL. So for this site, the primary land use in the surrounding area around the site was residential and light commercial. So when they did their baseline risk assessment, they evaluated a hypothetical on-facility resident, a commercial worker, and an instructor, construction worker. So again, based on the land use they could see of the surrounding area going into the RAFS, particularly the baseline risk assessment, they considered those scenarios so they had the appropriate exposure pathways being considered. And even though NASA had no intent to use the site for residential purposes anytime in the foreseeable future, by having a human health risk assessment that included that hypothetical residential use scenario, it really provided a bookend on the most conservative and protective results they could have when going forward and selecting their remedy. So you may have a more conservative land use scenario that you're using through the CERCLA process, but that is just to support what may be a reasonably anticipated future land use. So here they went that extra step, I would say, to be able to show, oh, we know that what we're doing here is safe and that it supports any reasonable land use that may occur here. Okay. Finishing up on this piece of EPA guidance, keep in mind that remedial action objectives should be developed in order to develop those alternatives that would are going to get you to the cleanup you need, those cleanup levels associated with that reasonably anticipated future land use over as much of the site as possible. Granted, some federal facility sites are very large, and it might not have the same land use assumption across hundreds of square miles of land. They're not all that large, but many of them are. Some areas may be recreational or industrial, depending on what's happening at the site. So, again, you want to be able to have those remedial action objectives that are going to support the long-term cleanup. In cases where the future land use is relatively certain, the remedial action objectives generally should reflect this in land use. For example, if you have a landfill site, it's highly likely that the future land use will remain unchanged from a long-term waste management area. That landfill is going to be there essentially in perpetuity. You're not anticipating that there would be major changes to the land use there. That's just a simple example, but we have a couple of case studies that we'll share with you. So now I'd like to hand it over to Jill to introduce herself and talk to us about reuse.
Thank you, Emmy. My name is Jill Apachin, and I also work in EPA's Federal Facility Restoration and Reuse Office. And we'll get right into it. We'll talk about site reuse. It's one of my favorite topics in the Superfund program. These examples on the screen are winners of the National Federal Facilities Excellence in Site Reuse Award. We created this award to celebrate all the great cleanup and reuse work that occurs at federal facility sites. This award highlights redevelopment successes and recognizes sites for the site cleanup and reuse and greatly benefit local communities around the country. These sites can also be used as models for your cleanup work. And so I highly encourage you to take a look at them because they have tremendous reuse examples. The common denominator of all these winners, there are 22 and counting, that it takes a team, as Emmy mentioned, to achieve positive reuse results, including strong partnerships and a collaboration vision shared by the community, other federal agencies, tribes, states, territories, local partners, politicians, developers, et cetera. They're different for every site, but those are a common theme. If you would like more information about the National Federal Facilities Excellence in Site Reuse Award, there will be a link dropped into the chat. On the screen, some examples include the former Marine Corps Air Station El Toro. El Toro was decommissioned as an active base in 1999 under the Base Realignment and Closure Act, BRAC. We will discuss base closures later in this presentation. Before the site was decommissioned, the nearly 5,000-acre site supported the Fleet Marine Forces in the Pacific Ocean, serving as a major West Coast jet fighter facility. Environmental impacts were the result of chlorinated solvent releases associated with the historical on-site station, aircraft, and vehicle maintenance activities. Extensive cleanup efforts have facilitated the transformation of approximately 1,300 acres of the site. So not the entire site, but a big portion of it. In 2001, Orange County voters passed a measure authorizing the station's redevelopment as a park and a preserve for mixed public and private use, which resulted in the development of the Greig Park. If you have a chance, I would highly recommend you look it up. It's a very impressive cleanup. It's a recreational destination that includes parks, playgrounds, hiking trails, multi-use facilities, an art complex, amphitheater, a police fire training facility, and an indoor ice rink, which serves as the training facility for the National Hockey League's Anaheim Ducks franchise. This reuse approach demonstrates how successful partnerships between public and private entities and the local community can facilitate the transformation of a military facility with significant environmental issues into a multi-use area that is an asset to the community. And on the top right-hand side, there's the NIROP, or the Naval Industrial Reserve Ordnance Plant, also known as NIRAP. NIROP was an 80-acre Superfund site where industrial activities, including the production of naval guns during World War II, contaminated soil and the groundwater. After cleanup, a developer purchased part of the site and the surrounding property and redeveloped it into the Northern Stacks Industrial Park. Today, the park is home to multiple businesses, including a brewery. And these businesses employ over 1,100 people and generate an estimated $600 million in annual revenue. This free development showcases the community benefits that can come from the reuse of vacant properties, including reducing blight and generating tax revenue. So before NIROC was redeveloped, it was redeveloped after the property was remained vacant, as well as surrounding properties. So the redevelopment of this site was a big asset to the community. And we'll move on to talk about the economic analysis and inventory of redeveloping federal facility superfund sites. As can see from the previous slides, federal facility superfund sites are being cleaned up across the country, helping communities reclaim and reuse thousands of acres of formerly contaminated land. Many sites are now host to parks, businesses, renewable energy facilities, wildlife habitat, neighborhoods, and farms. Our office tracks these sites from year to year to give a general overview of the beneficial effects associated with cleaning these sites up. We collect information about the number of businesses located on a site, the number of people employed at the businesses, annual employment income from on-site jobs, and annual sales revenue generated by businesses on-site. The Federal Facility Superfund reuse data is remarkable. It's off the charts. It has so much reuse potential. In 2023, the economic analysis of 91 of our federal facility Superfund sites identified more than 2,700 businesses and generated nearly $29 billion in annual sales, provided more than 600,000 jobs, and $60 billion in estimated annual employment income. In addition, we embarked on an inventory study, and from 2021 through 2023, we tracked nearly 6,300 reuse instances across 108 federal facility Superfund sites. Of these sites, all of them were in reuse or continued use. As you can see from the summary, the largest type of reuses are commercial and ecological. I also want to point out that there are 39 sites with alternative energy reuses. If you would like more information on this economic redevelopment data, including site snapshots, please visit our economic redevelopment website that will be in the chat. Now let's take a closer look at one of the alternative energy sites, the Plantex plant in Texas. Gee, would you please cue the video?
Sorry, bear with me one moment. Let me pull that video up here.
This part of the nation has always been known for its ability to produce energy, with oil being a major part of the economy. Currently, though, just about everywhere you look, oil derricks are being overshadowed by wind turbines. According to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the latest figures show Texas is the biggest producer of wind energy, with more than 15% of the state's generation originating in the skies above. Currently, it's estimated there are about 11,000 Lone Star turbines, and five of the tallest can be found across the street from the Pantex plant. A few years ago, the federal government mandated that by 2020, renewable energy would account for 20% of the power needs for its facilities.
About 2009, they started doing alternative studies. We had a requirement, a federal requirement, that was supposed to go into effect in 2020 to have 20% of our energy provided by a renewable source. And so we started working on it about 2009, doing some trade-off studies. Mostly it came down between solar and wind energy. And we decided on wind energy. It was the most cost-effective for our location at the time.
That government-backed pilot program, the Pantex Renewable Energy Project, or PREP, is considered a success. Within the first few months of production, the turbines, towering 400 feet above the ground, were creating the equivalency of about 60% of the electrical needs of Pantex.
I think it's immensely successful. It's the first of its kind for the DOE to do a behind-the-meter wind application, where we tie the wind generation directly to plant load. It basically, we prove the engineering here works, and then for viability anywhere else, it's just the economics of whether their rates at that site justify the cost savings to doing the project.
The renewable side also posts some impressive numbers. Check this out. Generating more than 43 million kilowatt hours of electricity is equal to the power consumption of 3,800 homes. Conversely, the carbon footprint has diminished dramatically, equal to removing 7,800 cars from the roads or planting 920,000 trees. All this with a combined cost savings of $2.8 million annually.
It's a viable source of renewable energy. In the Panhandle, the Midwest, we prove that you can put it behind the meter application, then it just becomes the economics of the tariffs that you're under and the rates you have to pay.
Renewable wind energy is now a permanent part of the High Plains landscape, with turbines stretching from border to border. It's also home to the federal government's pilot program to use renewable energy sources at its facility, namely Pantex.
But the first DOE facility to have renewable energy, and we know we're by far the greatest generator because we're generating about 60% of our energy needs, and nobody else is even close to that in the DOE.
Thank you. That was definitely an impressive reuse example. I also want to talk about the Repowering America's Land Initiative. It's a sister office that encourages renewable energy development. If you have a site that you want or considering renewable energy, I would recommend contacting this office. They also have the Repowering Mapper, which is a tool that provides information on renewable energy potential for contaminated sites. And that link will be dropped in the chat as well. Now let's talk about the reuse assessments. The reuse assessment is a tool to develop reasonable anticipated future land use assumptions. The 2001 reuse assessments, a tool to implement the Superfund Land Use Directive, or I'll call it the Superfund Land Use Directive that Emmy previously discussed and shared in this link, promotes early discussions with the community and other interested parties regarding potential future land use options for sites and promotes the use of that information to develop realistic assumptions that are integrated into the response actions. This is an important step toward facilitating the reuse of sites following cleanup. The reuse assessment involves collecting and evaluating information to develop assumptions about reasonably anticipated future land uses at Superfund sites. The scope and level of detail of the reuse assessments should be site-specific and tailored to the complexity of the site, the extent of the contamination, the level of redevelopment activity that has already occurred at the site, and the density of development in the vicinity of the site. It should be noted that reuse assessments should not have the greatest greatest applicability to sites with waste materials on the surface and or contaminated soil. Future groundwater use was not extensively considered in the Superfund Land Use Directive. There are separate expectations established in the NCP that state EPA expects to return usable groundwaters to their beneficial uses wherever practicable within a timeframe and that is reasonable given in the particular circumstances of the site. Stating that a lot of these reuses do have groundwater treatments in place and the sites can be reused anyhow in conjunction with the groundwater treatments. We'll see an example of that as we move forward. Continuing the reuse assessment, as we see at federal facility Superfund sites where another federal agency or OFA is performing a CERCLA-based remedial action or non-time critical removal, the OFA should develop assumptions of reasonably anticipated future land use as part of the response process consistent with the Superfund Land Use Directive. The 2001 Land Use Directive contains an outline for the reuse assessment. I highly recommend that you reference this if you're developing a reuse assessment. It identifies the stakeholders, for example, site owners, developers, state, local, and tribal governments, community members, RABs, site description, environmental conditions such as contaminants, potential restrictions, wetlands, et cetera, site ownership, land use considerations such as zoning, site master plans, institutional controls, historical and cultural resources, community input, public initiatives such as infrastructure plans and funds available, et cetera. Information obtained from the reuse assessment can be useful during the planning stages of the response action, including the baseline risk assessments when estimating potential future risk, the development of remedial action objectives or RAOs, and the development and evaluation of response alternatives. and the selection of the appropriate response action required for the protection of human health and the environment. Since federal facility sites are often encompass thousands of acres with buildings, roads, and other infrastructure, their effective and efficient cleanup and reuse can play a pivotal role in a community's economic growth and neighborhood revitalization and makes them great candidates for site reuse. Large sites or sites with many operable units and potentially different future use scenarios may benefit from multiple reuse assessments. While a reuse assessment may not be necessary at every site, or OU, the lead agency or OFA should collect and summarize available information about potential future uses for MPL sites and non-time critical removal actions to form the basis for the future of the land use assumptions. I'd like to draw your attention to the Superfund redevelopment mapper that will be dropped into the chat. This is another web-based tool that explores potential reuse opportunities. It highlights the site features and surrounding areas to explore more information about the communities, including infrastructure, income levels, unemployment numbers, and land features. All right, let's go to another example. This is one of my favorite examples. I actually was an intern at Fernald Preserve in the late 90s, and it has come a long way since then. But Fernald, formerly called the Feeds Material Production Center, is a former U.S. Department of Energy uranium processing facility in rural Southwest Ohio. Remedial actions have addressed contamination at the site, and long-term groundwater cleanup is underway. The remedial process at this site engaged community members and federal and state agencies in a process that integrated remedial planning and future land use considerations. Ecological restoration was envisioned by the community, which advocated for remediation to an undeveloped park with an emphasis on wildlife. Components of ecological restoration were incorporated into the design plan for the site remedy. Fernald has great examples of how the reuse vision was incorporated into the remedy, as evidenced by the Mesic Tallgrass Prairie community planted on an on-site disposal facility cap. The use of the native vegetation also had a more practical benefit. The perennial bunch grasses and forbs that make up the Mesic Tallgrass Prairies are very hardy, grow in nutrient-poor conditions, are drought-tolerant, discourage establishment of invasive weed species, and prevent erosion of remediated areas. These features make native grasslands an ideal cap for the on-site disposal facility and for stabilization of highly disturbed remediated areas. The infrastructure designed to support the public use of the site also incorporates several other features. A concrete pad that supported remediation activities is now the visitor center's parking lot. Former maintenance and access roads were incorporated into trail design. A stormwater sediment basin is now a biotreatment wetland that handles wastewater from the visitor center. Renewable energy generated by a geothermal system is used to heat and cool the visitor center. This heated and cooling infrastructure is located in an on-site pond that was left as a result of remediation. In addition, renewable solar energy is used to power lights and gates across the site. This innovative and cost-effective cleanup transformed a contaminated site into a publicly accessible ecological preserve of 140 acres of wetlands, 350 acres of prairies, 400 acres of forest, hiking trails, and a visitor center. It's now a community asset. The Fernald Preserve fosters wildlife habitat and provides educational opportunities through environmental stewardship. This site was also a recipient of the 2019 National Federal Facilities Excellence in Site Reuse Award. The fact sheet can be seen, the link is in the chat. All right, let's get back to the guidance. We'll discuss the 2010 directive considering reasonably anticipated future land use and reducing barriers to reuse at EPA-led Superfund sites. It's also referred to as the reuse directive. Future land use assumptions or designations may change at any stage of the circular response process, as we discussed during the poll. If it happens before broad signature, before the record of decision is signed, The lead federal agency, NEPA, determined if that change is the reasonably anticipated future land use assumption, and they should be integrated into the remedy selection. The agencies should refer to the 1995 Land Use Directive and may need to supplement or revise other key documents, such as the Baseline Risk Assessment, the Real Investigation Feasibility Study, or RIFS, or the proposed plan. Next, we have a poll. G, would you please queue up the poll?
Absolutely. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to click a few buttons here and we are going to pull up that poll. And we'll launch the poll here as I'm calling up on the screen. Okay, so we have a scenario where we'll ask you to apply your understanding. If you can't see the narrative on the slide, you can move the poll window or slide it out of the way, but I'll also read it to you now. Laboratory X is located on a military base and is currently under federal ownership. The area is part of an NPL Superfund site and is primarily used for laboratories, office space, and parking lots. The military base plans to transfer ownership of the lab and its associated buildings to city ownership in the future. So the question we're asking you to consider, what is the anticipated future land use for this site? You'll see a series of options below that question, and you can either select A, residential, B, agricultural, C, industrial, or D, recreational. So consider that information and then simply click the circle to the left of the answer and submit your response. It looks like about 40, almost 50% of you have submitted an answer. We will talk about the response and what the correct answer is in this situation in just a moment. So I'll give you all a few more seconds to consider your answer and to submit your vote. Remember, if you're having any problems with that poll, the slides are there on the screen and you can simply type your response into a message in the Q&A if that's easier. So it looks like about two-thirds of the audience have cast their results, and I see those responses slowing down. So I'll go ahead and end the poll here in 3, 2, 1. And let's take a look at the results. About 83% of the audience picked C, industrial, but some people felt it might be A, residential. What's the right answer?
Great. Well, great job. The right answer is industrial. The current land use is industrial, and it is intended that it will stay that way since it's a large infrastructure of laboratories, office space, and parking lots. So if you selected industrial, you are correct. If you selected residential, that's okay too. Like if the land use were to change, left there's, we don't know what the site looks like. And if it's in an area that has other residential areas around it, it could change in the future. And if that were the case, then we'd have to go back and look at the risk assessments and see if that is a possible reuse. But good job, everybody. Now, we will move on to the next slide and continue talking about the 2010 reuse directive. So what happens if your ROD is already signed and there is a reuse? This happens all the time. And that's why the 2010 reuse directive was introduced, because many sites are already past remedy selection and regents wanted to know what to do if a reasonably anticipated future use change after the ROD was signed. And that is then addressed in the 1995 land use directive. So the 2010 reuse directive also considers this scenario. And when a land use change occurs after a ROD is signed, the lead federal agency and EPA should evaluate the proposed change to see whether it will affect the protectiveness of the remedy and if remedy modifications would be necessary to allow the changed land use. If a change in the remedy is necessary, a ROD modification, such as a proposed plan, ESD, or RADA, may be necessary. Land use changes are also evaluated during the five-year review process. And then there's another Federal Facility Academy webinar for that. So if you're interested, please check that out. So for more information on this guidance, Gina has already dropped it into the chat. So I highly recommend referring to that as well. So next, we have another poll. Jean, will you please take us through it?
Absolutely. So I'm going to go ahead and relaunch a similar question here, but the scenario is different. So let me send that poll back out to you. And in this case, we're asking you to consider land along a river that is part of a federal facility NPL Superfund site, and it's currently under federal ownership. The area was primarily used for chemical processing activities and is being cleaned up under CERCLA. The city is interested in developing the land for hiking trails. In this situation, what is the anticipated future land use for the site? Is it A, residential, B, agricultural, C, industrial, or D, recreational? Again, we'll ask you to click the circle to the left of your answer and then hit submit. Now, in this case, again, the audience seems completely honed in on one particular answer. So I'm going to go ahead and close this one down here in 3, 2, 1. And looking at these results, almost 100% of the responses picked D, recreational.
Wow, that's impressive. Great job. That is the correct answer. It will be recreational because the city plans to develop it for hiking trails. It's a great job. All right, now we're going to go back to the 2010 reuse directive. In summary, productive reuse of a site can provide many benefits to a community and support the effectiveness of remedy selection. For example, reusing a site can avoid inappropriate activities such as illegal dumping or off-road vehicle use and extend the re remedy's protectiveness. Widespread support of the property's reuse activities may also re result in increased interest in maintaining the effectiveness of the remedy. Reuse can also benefit communities by maintaining or increasing property values for land on and near a site, as well as improving quality of life through amenities such as parks, open spaces, and providing significant local economic benefits and neighborhood identity. I didn't realize I did that. Next, we'll talk about institutional controls. EPA defines institutional controls as non-engineered instruments such as administrative and legal controls that help to minimize the potential for exposure to contamination or protect the integrity of a response action. ICs typically are designed to work by limiting land use and/or resource use, or by providing information that helps modify or guide human behavior at a site. Institutional controls are a subset of land use controls, or LUCs. LUCs include engineered and physical barriers, such as fences and security guards, as well as ICs. The federal facility program may use either term ICs or LUCs interchangeably. I want to point out that ICs or LUCs are part of the selective remedy and are required on any federal facility site that leaves waste in place or has not achieved UUUE, unrestricted use, unrestricted exposure. As an example, a selected remedy that includes a response action of a capped landfill relies on an IC to help ensure protectiveness. An IC or LUC is necessary to prohibit heavy machinery usage on or near a capped site while allowing for light recreational land uses, such as a soccer field, that do not result in unacceptable risk. As components of remedial actions, institutional controls are used to achieve the precise restrictions articulated in the decision documents that are needed at a site to achieve cleanup objectives. I recommend looking at the institutional control guidance that will, we also call it the PIME guidance, that will be inserted to this chat. All right, now I'm going to turn it back over to Emmy.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you so much for taking us through reuse. We're going to talk about BRAC for a second, starting off with an example of a success that was had at a BRAC site in Myrtle Beach. So in the pictures you see here, the Myrtle Beach Air Force Base, or I should say former, was a 3,900, oh, apologies, 3,900 acre site, but now it hosts Myrtle Beach International Airport, over 1,200 new homes, lots of parks, walking paths, sporting facilities to, really engage the community, a golf course, a college. There's a business park there as well and a booming commercial district. So for those who are less familiar with BRAC, let's talk a little bit more about what base closures are. So for closures at bases where cleanup is being conducted, you can have a few different scenarios. I should also mention that EPA was more heavily involved in cleanup at BRAC sites up until about 2016. I believe that was the fifth round of BRAC. And after that time, EPA has not been as involved. We essentially, those resources were pooled for EPA's participation in 2016. But we still have some great, I mean, cleanup is still happening. There's some great reuse successes that are happening, and we love to recognize those. With base closures, you could have a couple of different scenarios. It might be that a base is going to be closed, but the plan is for that land to remain in Department of Defense ownership with no plans for transfer. You could have a scenario where base closure is happening, but there are established plans to transfer the land that considers zoning, anticipated reuse, all of that. And there's also base closures where the plan is to transfer the land back to another federal agency. So that property transfer has a specific process that it has to go under. So when you're looking at cleanup of a different federal facility site, the land use assumptions at sites undergoing base closure may be different than at sites where the federal agency is planning to maintain control of the facility, essentially in perpetuity, with no plans to transfer it to any party or any other federal agency. We just wanted to touch on that. Lots of successes there. Although EPA does not play a big role as of 2016, these cleanups are ongoing and they are part of considerations for the reuse awards, right, Jill? We can consider BRAC sites and cleanups.
Yes, that is a category of our reuse awards.
Awesome. All right. Just wanted to touch on BRAC before we continued on. At this time, though, I would like to hand over the mic to our other instructor, Jeff. I'll give him an opportunity to introduce himself, and he'll talk to us about on-site and off-site determinations.
Well, good day, everyone. Yeah, thank you, Emmy. We're going to talk a little bit about on-site and off-site determinations, so we'll get right into it. Before we get going, let's start with a group poll. So what I want to ask is, what challenges have you dealt with in on-site and off-site determinations? So Jill, will you guide us through that, please? Or excuse me, Jean.
That's okay. So this is a pretty straightforward question, and the response is going to come in a form by sending a message in the Q&A. So there's no new floating window. I'll simply direct those of you to who haven't done so yet. Go ahead and click the Q&A box on your screen, and let's go ahead and type in your response to that question by sending a message into the Q&A. What challenges have you dealt with in on-site, off-site determinations? And then I'll start summarizing some of those responses as they come in. If you've had no challenges, you can put no challenges in as a response. We will take that. Just in the interest of time, we don't have the opportunity to take any verbal comments here, but I am seeing some responses. So many, I've got a number of people who are saying they've had no challenges because they're new employees. So they haven't yet had the opportunity to experience this. Others are chiming in that they've had local tribal considerations. There's been a challenge defining on-site. Treated wastewater final destinations, institutional controls, and someone was kind enough to just say many in all capitals. They've just had many challenges. Unrealistic expectations of the local community. There were limitations. They had UXO in off-base areas and offshore. A few other people, again, chiming in with tribal. There was a third party who performed work under an IC, and they weren't sure if the offsite rule would apply or not. But it looks like, without a doubt, most people are new, and they have not yet had a chance to have a challenge. That's the most common answer I'm seeing.
Well, very good. Thank you for taking the time to answer. We're going to have a couple examples of the site that I'm a project manager on, which is the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. And I've been with the agency for just about 3 years, so I know exactly what it feels like to be new, so you're not alone. But we'll talk about the Hanford site and a couple other examples of determinations as we go through. So thank you for your input. And hopefully by the end of this, you'll have a little more understanding of how to go through this process if you have not before. So we'll get it started. So offsite determinations, what is the offsite rule? Well, it applies to any circular response action involving the offsite transfer of any hazardous waste substance, pollutant, or contaminant, also known as circular waste. Circular waste may only be placed in a facility operating in compliance with the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA, or other applicable federal or state requirements. What is the purpose of the OCR? The purpose of the OCR is to ensure CERCLA does not contribute to present or future environmental problems. So the interpretation of the OSR originates from the NCP, the National Contingency Plan, at 400 CFR 300.440, titled Procedures and Planning and Procedures for Planning and Implementing Offsite Response Actions. The OCR establishes the criteria and procedures for determining whether facilities are acceptable for receipt of CERCLA waste from response actions authorized or funded under CERCLA. And that's one that I think is important, because oftentimes we think about a response action being done by a federal agency or EPA or a private party, but also applies to any action that's funded by Superfund or CERCLA. It also establishes compliance criteria and release criteria, and establishes a process for determining whether facilities are acceptable based on those criteria. For the purpose of the OSR, as I discussed, is to avoid having CERCLA waste from response actions authorized or funded under CERCLA to contribute the present or future environmental problems by directing these wastes to management units determined to be environmentally sound. So that is the exact verbiage for understanding that rule. And on the homepage that Jill talked about, and in your participant manual, you'll see some links. And one of them is for the fact sheet for the offsite rule. So you can check that out if you're curious about specifics for that. So offsite determinations, what actions are affected? Well, any remedial or removal action involving the offsite transfer of any hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant that is conducted by EPA, states, private parties, or other federal agencies, and or if the action is Superfund financed. Included are cleanups at federal facilities under Section 120 of CERCLA, and cleanups under Section 311 of the Clean Water Act, or CWA, except for cleanup of certain petroleum materials that are exempt with CERCLA. If no CERCLA funds or authorities are involved, or the waste is not CERCLA waste, the OSR does not apply. So this here is a picture of what is called together it's called the liquid waste processing facilities, but at the lower part of your screen, you have the effluent treatment facility, and above it is the liquid effluent retention facility on the Hanford site. So the effluent treatment facility, or ETF, and the liquid effluent retention facility make up the entire liquid waste processing facility used to store, treat, and dispose of large volumes of waste on the Hanford site. It is a Washington State permitted facility under the Hanford site-wide RCRA permit. And Washington State, Washington State has an authorized RCRA program. So it's geographically located in what we call the 200 area NPL site, but is considered off-site for remedial action. So it sits within the site, but it is permitted and considered off-site for remedial actions. The effluent treatment facility, or ETF we call it, receives liquids from the liquid effluent retention facility, or LERF, which is permitted by the state and has three storage basins designed to hold about 23 million gallons of material. And you'll see in the picture there that it has a excavated LRF basin 41. I know that that is actually lined now. I can't remember if it's in operation, but it has expanded recently. So this is a little bit of an outdated picture, but it gives the idea of the LRF facility. LRF stores liquid waste, ETF treats them. LRF accepts and stores wastewaters from a number of sources on the Hanford site. Once wastewater has been treated through ETF or the effluent treatment facility, it is stored until tests confirm that various radioactive and hazardous contaminants have been removed or lowered to levels that make it acceptable for discharge to a state-approved disposal site within the Hanford 200 area, as we call it. The treated waste is then discharged as non-hazardous waste, and secondary waste from these treatment processes is concentrated into it and dried into a powder in the ETF secondary treatment system, or excuse me, the train, packaged and sent to, and I'll talk a little bit about it later, but it's sent to the Hanford Environmental Restoration and Disposal Facility. So for the Spring Hill landfill that we have here, I think we have a video for this. Is that right, Jean?
We absolutely do. And I'm going to call that video up right now. It's coming up here on the screen.
Okay. So hello, I'm Rob Pope. I am a senior RPM in Region 4, Atlanta, Georgia. And I have done some of this, determining land use and determining on-site and off-site for different uses as we go through remedial action. And I'm happy that you guys can sit in on this webinar. Thanks. So here is an example of a very common off-site rule facility. This is called the Spring Hill Landfill. It is in Northwest Florida. It receives waste from Tyndall Air Force Base regularly. It is basically a Subtitle D RCRA permitted landfill. And so it is a solid waste landfill. So they cannot take hazardous waste, but there's a lot of the waste that comes off the base that is not hazardous waste that still is CERCLA waste. And so this facility has to be CERCLA offsite rule approved. And basically, what happens is the facility, which is managed by Waste Management, is in contact with the offsite rule coordinator. Each region has one. They're normally in the RCRA division or the division that holds the RCRA group. And then that offsite rule coordinator can tell you if the facility you're looking at is offsite rule authorized. This one has also received waste from Deepwater Horizon, for instance. And so we used it under other CERCLA response actions. It's about 68 miles from Tyndall Air Force Base, so it's not insignificant to truck things 68 miles from the base, which is right on the edge of the water, to this landfill. It's upper in the upper part of the county, well above flood lines and hurricane concerns. But it's a good, safe option to put that Subtitle D waste. And sometimes what Tyndall has had to do is treat and stabilize waste so that it is not hazardous waste, and then they can ship it to this landfill. And this landfill is very careful about checking to make sure that it has been treated appropriately. One thing to be aware of with these offsite rule facilities is that the determinations do expire. The offsite rule coordinator doesn't give them a carte blanche. It's yes, right now it's fine, because if they start having violations of their RCRA permit out of the state or something like that, the offsite rule coordinator should be aware of those and will probably take away that offsite rule determination until they have addressed those concerns from the state authorized permit. And it doesn't have to be a RCRA landfill. It can be some other kind of landfill, but it has to have this offsite rule acceptability. And this is probably the most common one of these Subtitle D landfills. Subtitle C landfills, of course, always have these as well.
Thank you, Gene. So let's talk for a moment about permit requirements. So permit requirements. Permits are required for CERCLA work conducted off-site but not on-site. The NCP section 40 CFR 300.40 states that no federal, state, or local permits are required for on-site response actions conducted pursuant to CERCLA sections 104, 106, 120, 121, or 122. The term on-site means the aerial extent of contamination and all suitable areas in very close proximity to the contamination necessary for implementation of the response action. So again, permits, if required, shall be obtained for all responsive activities conducted off-site. And note that the site is defined in the record of decision. So when the ROD is done, the site is defined in the ROD. While responsible parties or federal facilities are not required to obtain a permit for on-site activities, they must meet the substantive requirements of the various statutes that do apply.
Jeff, I'm going to jump in here. I'm so sorry, just to interject. We have been going pretty far and we did not pause yet for questions. So I apologize. We are doing great on time and I want to stop before we go any further and make sure we take just a few moments here for a few questions, if that's okay. So I'm going to go ahead and add the other speakers in on the queue with our video sources so that we can start to take some of those questions as they're coming in. If you've already typed in a question into the Q&A window, don't worry, it's in there. If you are in the middle of typing it in, keep typing it in. We're going to start with a few questions that came in earlier. And Emmy, I'm going to direct the question to you and hopefully you can help move it through the presenters as needed. So if it's okay, there were a few questions that came in earlier about changing land use scenarios. And so one of the attendees noted that they understood how a federal facility can change their use in the future. So for example, going from a residential scenario to a commercial or industrial use, because they're going from a more conservative risk situation to a less conservative situation. But if it was the opposite, so let's say it was a commercial or industrial land, and then they wanted to change it to a residential use, and the cleanup goals were met for those industrial receptors, would the government come out to that federal facility and then reassess or perform additional cleanup if it's going to shift over to residential use?
So in saying would the government come out and check, I would say it's the responsibility of the lead agency to ensure that the remedies remain protective. That's also part of the reason why we do five-year reviews at sites that leave waste in place that don't allow for unlimited use, unlimited exposure. So yes, the lead agency, along with the regulatory agencies, are going to look at that change in land use. And that this is not a hypothetical. This has happened at several federal facility sites where perhaps when the cleanup was done, they thought it was going to remain industrial. 15 years later, population is growing and now there's interest in putting condos or what have you, residential housing on that land. So before that can happen, we had mentioned earlier, those pathways have to be reevaluated to see if the cleanup that was implemented is protective enough to support that new land use. If not, there may be necessity for a ESD or a ROD amendment to be issued to conduct additional activities to meet that protectiveness. Jill, did you want to add anything? Did I miss anything on that?
No, I think that was a perfect explanation. Definitely that we do see that a lot, and we support if it's a more conservative land reuse, and oftentimes sort of the other federal agencies. So we go through the risk assessments and all the documents that we described before to make sure that if we have to make modifications to the remedy, that we'll do that and that the site will be protective.
Great, excellent. We did have a quick question on one of the early poll questions asking about Laboratory X in that scenario. They were just curious, how would you know that the land use changed from industrial to residential? Is there a notification process that happens?
Yes. Yes, definitely. If there's a land use control, EPA has to be consulted. A part of the enforcement documentation with institutional controls, which are necessary for any federal facility superfund site that has waste left in place, has enforceable information in that document that states that the EPA and the states, if they're part of the FFA, need to be notified and have concurrence with that change, that land use change. So the other federal agencies or a property owner cannot just change the land use control without coordinating with EPA.
Okay. And then talking about those categories for anticipated future use, one of the attendees wanted to know, why is commercial not a category that's used in your anticipated future use scenarios? Is commercial equivalent in or included with the phrase industrial? They note that a lot of municipalities use the term commercial in their zoning regulations, and potentially exposed populations are different than those in an industrial setting. So they're wondering if you could talk about that category.
Sure, I'll take that question. Our EPA, we have this guidance called regs, and it's one of those acronyms that we use that I can't recall what it stands for right now. Maybe it can help me, but that's our risk assessment guidance. And it has those four categories that any discuss, agricultural, industrial, residential, and recreational. And so that's what we don't deviate from those four categories. Even though commercial probably is part of the industrial reuse category, our regs are set up to have risk scenarios for each of those four land reuses. So that's why we use those four.
Okay. We just have a question here in terms of what's the most conservative reuse. Is residential considered to be the most conservative reuse scenario?
Yes.
Okay. All right, excellent. How about if your LUCs or your LUCs are required for federal facilities that don't meet UU, UE, and we have acronyms coming in, and I know there's some new people, so instructors, please feel free to define the acronyms in your response. Then they ask, who is responsible for restricting and verifying the LUCs are in place and effective? Does this tie into five-year reviews? And then who would be the anticipated lead reviewer for compliance? Is it Fed, states, local, tribal?
Sure, I'll take that question as well. That's a good question. UUUE stands for unrestricted use, unrestricted exposure. And it's land use controls or institutional controls are required at any site that federal facility superfund site that does not achieve UUUE. There's a part of the record of decision and decision documents for the site will have all the language for land use controls. I'll direct you to that. We have a land use control checklist on our website that I will provide the link to in a moment. But if you have all that language in their decision documents, they will be enforceable. With that language, usually it's the other federal agency, but if they transfer the property, they'll transfer the responsibility to the transferee, but there is their responsibility to do annual inspections on the property to make sure that the land use controls are effective and that the land use stays the same and has not changed. And then furthermore, anytime there is a federal facility with waste left in place, a five-year review is required. And so they'll do that. And that's another way to make sure that the land use is maintained and doesn't change. I think I answered all that question. It was a long question, so please let me know if I missed anything.
All right, excellent. Thank you. Let's take another question here. Why would you not want an LUC or a LUC restricting residential use if your risk assessment or remedy is based on future commercial industrial reuse? They just note that by including a residential restriction in your decision document, one could figure out pretty quickly if it was the failure to evaluate current potential residential use in the RI or your HHRA, so your human health risk assessment. There are instances that they note where necessary data was collected in the RI but not evaluated in the human health risk assessment because of reasonably anticipated reuse, and then other instances where the necessary data were never collected. So they just wanted to know if you could provide clarification on that. Why would you not want a LUC restricting residential use if the risk assessment is based on future commercial industrial reuse?
Well, first I'll answer that question Anytime that UUUE or unrestricted use, unrestricted exposure is not achieved, a lock is required because we want to make sure that 20 years down the road, when we all retire, that someone doesn't come along and be like, oh, this would be a great place to put a condo and it has a lot of contamination. So we just want to make sure that documentation is in place. In terms of the risk assessment, I'm not sure if I understood the question, but like we see it both ways where sometimes, like the example that Emmy gave with NASA, that they'll include residential to have a conservative risk assessment. And we like to see that because land uses can change and it's good to have that documentation already. So if there is a change, we can see like what the risks are and what the changes to the remedial selective remedy may be.
Okay.
But so that's site specific.
Okay. All right. And we did have, I would say, a seasoned staff member who just shared an experience. They shared a comment that some of the federal facility rods are so old that trying to figure out what additional work needs to occur in order to change future land use can be a very complex, I'm paraphrasing, job. And just a cautionary note that there's sometimes a lot of effort that needs to go in to the work to decide what needs to happen to change the future land use. And I'm seeing nodding heads, so it sounds like the instructors understand that comment and that perspective. Okay, excellent. Quick question here on offsite determinations. When you're looking at offsite determinations at a CERCLA site, what do you consider air discharges or treated effluent? Is it surface water? Like if that's going quote offsite and would therefore require a permit?
I would say we're going to cover this in Jeff's next section very much in detail so we can table that question and see if it gets answered.
All right. Well, then I think in the interest of time, let's progress and go back to the presentation. Thank you all so much for letting me interject, and we'll carry on.
Very good. And thanks for waiting on that question. And I hope that we're able to touch on that. And if not, we can circle back and talk more about that. Right now, I'm going to read a scenario regarding former Weldon Springs Ordnance Works in Missouri. This was a chemical plant, and you could see the picture here, an older picture of the chemical plant, and then a picture of an observation platform after it was cleaned up, a 75-foot tall permanent disposal cell that was created through the cleanup process. So the Weldon Spring former Army Ordnance Worksite, or WSOW, is in St. Charles County, Missouri, approximately 30 miles west of St. Louis. The site encompasses approximately 17,232 acres, including mixed areas of ownership, state and federally owned land parcels. The Army acquired the property in 1940 and began production of trinitrotoluene, or TNT, and dinitro, or excuse me, dinitrotoluene, DNT, in 1941 to support the World War II efforts. The Army constructed 18 identical TNT and two DNT manufacturing plants beginning in May 1941 in the area now known as Weldon Springs Training Area, or WSTA. Following deactivation of the production facility in 1945, the majority of the property was transferred to the state of Missouri and local entities. Historical Army operations resulted in the release of hazardous substances to the soil and groundwater at the site. The site was listed on the National Priority List in February of 1990, and a federal facility agreement, and you've heard us talk about them for some of your new folks, that's a FFA, became effective on August 8th in 1991. The WSOW site surrounds and is adjacent to the Weldon Springs Quarry Plant and Pit site. The Weldon Springs Quarry Plant and Pit site is a separate NPL site listed in 1989. The Department of Energy is the lead agency for the quarry pit plant site. So you have the Army, you have the state, you have the Department of Energy. So it can you can see it can get pretty complicated sometimes. Pardon me. So on August 9, 1994, Missouri invoked the FFA's dispute resolution procedures regarding the state's authority to require permits for the incinerator, contaminated wastewater treatment, and stormwater runoff activities that are described in the draft final record of decision. On September 7th in 94, the Dispute Resolution Committee elevated the matter to the Senior Executive Committee. Unable to unanimously resolve the dispute, it was elevated to the regional administrator within the EPA, as provided in the dispute resolution procedures of the federal facility agreement. Missouri elected to elevate the region's decision for resolution. And I just want to interject that this is elevated to the administrator of the EPA. So these decisions within NPL sites are decided by the administrator of the EPA. In this case, it is undisputed that the response actions at issue will be constructed entirely within the geographical area considered the NPL site. Missouri's position is that because of off-site releases and discharge will occur, the state may seek to require the Army to obtain permits. Throughout this dispute, the Army has asserted that permits are not required for subject activities. Furthermore, the Army has stated that it is unwilling to jeopardize the ability to carry out its CERCLA responsibilities by agreeing to apply for a state permit that CERCLA does not require. Missouri contends that what constitutes on-site in EPA's view is overbroad, and that the response actions under the selected remedy will inevitably result in extended off-site discharges beyond the quote unquote on-site area, and thus require state permits. So EPA has long viewed response actions that may have discharges or releases which subsequently migrate beyond site boundaries as qualifying for CERCLA 121E1 exemption. EPA excerpts that CERCLA Section 121 and the corresponding provision of the NCP at 300.400EI as exempting response actions conducted entirely on site, even if the actions involve discharges or emissions that result in subsequent migration of contaminants beyond the site boundaries. Since some off-site migration is likely to occur, in virtually all cases where there is an on-site discharge or emission, adopting the state's interpretation would greatly narrow the kinds of permits which the exception applies. So in this case, the EPA administrator at the time, Carol Browner's decision, stated that the EPA interprets CERCLA and the corresponding provisions in the NCP as exempting response actions conducted entirely on site, even if the actions involve discharges or emissions that result in subsequent migration of contaminants beyond the site boundary. So as previously mentioned, while responsible parties, and this is regarding on-site determinations now. As previously mentioned, while responsible parties or federal facilities are not required to obtain a permit, they must meet requirements and the permits and various statutes that apply. So even though the permit is not required, the requirements within the statutes do apply. The Resource Conservation and Recovery Act is a good example of this and must be adhered to when handling hazardous wastes on site. For example, small quantity generators can only keep their waste on site for 180 days or 270 days if their treatment, storage, and disposal facility is more than 270 miles away. Large quantity generators can only store waste for 90 days without obtaining a permit as a storage facility. Also, RCRA, Corrective Active Management Units, or CAMUs, are used to deal with on-site hazardous waste. They facilitate treatment and storage and disposal of hazardous waste managed for implementing cleanup and remove disincentives for cleanup that RCRA can impose on these wastes. So there are links and details regarding small quantity generators, large quantity generators, and CAMUs in the presentation manual that was provided, as well as the homepage that Gene talked about at the beginning of our presentation. So earlier I talked about the Hanford Environmental Restoration and Disposal Facility when I was talking about the LRF ETF facility. The Hanford Environmental Restoration Disposal Facility, or what we call ERDF, is in the 200 area of the Hanford site and is a massive landfill regulated by EPA under CERCLA. It's established under a record of decision and was built in 1996. ERDF accepts low-level radioactive, hazardous, and mixed wastes that are generated during the CERCLA cleanup remediation activities at Hanford. And it's worth noting that this disposal site only takes waste generated on-site. It does not take waste generated off the Hanford site. And Hanford's the Hanford Rod states that the ERDF that ERDF is on-site for the responses of remedial action. ERDF meets the substantive, and then this is important, ERDF meets the substantive requirements of RCRA, but is not a RCRA permitted landfill. So it is considered on site. The facility is designed to keep the environment safe by isolating waste and leachate from the environment. Leachate's collected and sent to a large water treatment facility in the 200 West area where contaminants are removed. And you can see a little map here kind of where ERDF is, and just north of that is where the treatment facility is. So ERDF is a large engineered landfill used for the disposal of low-level radioactive, chemical, and mixed waste generated from demolition, remediation, and other cleanup activities across the Hanford site. It covers an area of approximately 107 acres and its size provides tremendous flexibility in disposing of different waste forms ranging from soils to large pieces of contaminated equipment. ERDF is composed of 8 original disposal cells, and you can see it up in the picture on the upper left-hand corner, and 2 supercells that are twice as large as the original cells. Each supercell is designed to hold approximately 3.6 million tons of material, and the original cells were constructed in pairs, with each cell measuring approximately 500 feet wide, 500 feet long, and 70 feet deep. And you see in the picture there on the upper left, a black bordered proposed supercell 11. Supercell 11 is currently in the planning phase, and as the picture shows, will mirror the adjacent cell. And so that is, we're going through the process of planning now for Supercell 11. So on-site determinations. On-site is defined in 40 CFR 300.40E as, again, the aerial extent of contamination and all suitable areas in a very close proximity to the contamination necessary for implementation of the response action. Used to determine that waste from a specific site or OU, operable unit, can be moved across an area outside of the OU boundary to another location, technically within the larger site. So again, the definition for on-site per the CFR was designed to create additional space for treatment systems that require considerable area for construction and staging areas. Areas not covered by this definition are said to be off-site. For example, contaminated debris, soil may be sent to a waste disposal facility or treatment facility located at another area of the site within the boundary identified within the ROD. So here is another apply your understanding, and I'll read the scenario really quickly before we have the window that pulls up over it. In this scenario, would the laydown area be considered on site for the purposes of an OU1 response action? And you can see OU1 in blue to the left, an equipment laydown area in purple on the right, and within the red NPL site. So. Here in the OU, here the OU and the equipment laydown area are in close proximity to one another, and both are located on the same NPL site. So what do you think? Gene, you want to cue this up and see what people are thinking?
Absolutely. So there is a new pop-up poll that is on the screen asking, should the laydown area be considered on-site for the purposes of an OU1 response action? And you're going to have three answers. You can pick A, yes, B, no, or C, sometimes. And then once you pick your option by clicking the circle to the left of the answer that you think is correct, hit that submit button. And it does look like the answers are coming in rapidly. Almost half of the audience have cast their vote. And I am looking here and double checking to see if you're unsure, that's okay. Just take your best guess and submit. Otherwise, you can type a response into the Q&A if that's easier regarding this question. Looks like the answers are starting to slow down. So I'll go ahead and close this poll in 3, 2, 1, and let's look. So it looks like in this case, it was about half of the audience picked A, but there was a pretty, I'm seeing some nodding heads, but the other half was split between B and C. So what's the right answer, Jeff?
So this is one of those very unsatisfying answers, right, that sometimes applies. So things that you want to consider in this scenario, have a similar response action, have similar response actions on the site, used a laydown area in this manner that were located away from the OU. Is there a concern contamination could spread to other parts of the MPL site due to traveling between the laydown area and the OU? Or what are the reasons for having the laydown area be at that location? Does it improve efficiencies? So it just outlines the fact that in a case like this, sometimes it can be appropriate, sometimes it may not. It requires discussion with all the of the parties involved to figure out what is best protects, you know, the human health and the environment, meets regulation, and is appropriate for the cleanup that we're doing. I know it's very unsatisfying, but you know, we do have to have some of those questions. So anyway, I think that's it for me. Emmy, I think you've got the summary. Is that right?
Yes, thank you, Jeff. And yes, unsatisfying, but accurate nonetheless. So for everyone who joined us today, thank you so much. We are going to just go through our summary and take a few last questions since we have some time for that. But with today's webinars, we talked about how important land use determinations are, as from risk assessment to remedy selection under CERCLA, and also the importance of identifying that anticipated future land use as early as possible through a very large process that includes community, other groups that are going to be affected by the cleanup. Also, considering reuse and remedy selection. The earlier you can consider reuse, the better you can choose remedies that will support that reuse. However, if that reuse consideration comes later in the process, that's fine as well. We definitely support beneficial reuse where it can be implemented across our federal facility sites. With the offsite rules at OSR, again, the whole point of that is to make sure we're not making future Superfund sites. We do not want to contribute to present or future environmental problems. And when it comes to permits for on-site activities, CERCLA does not require permits for those on-site activities. However, the substantive portions of those requirements still need to be met through the CERCLA cleanup. So, Jean, I'd like to check in with you and see if we have any remaining questions.
Thank you. We do have just a handful of questions left, and I do want to let the audience know that we have time for questions. So if you are in the midst of typing a question in, please go ahead. If you weren't sure, now is the time to get that question in. And we'll wait to see if some additional ones come in, but let me turn to some that are currently in the queue. So regarding your on-site disposal cells, do they also have to follow state requirements?
If those state requirements are considered ARARs, then yes, they would have to follow those requirements. And again, it's the substantive portions. If there's administrative type of requirements that would be required through the state's requirements, those would not necessarily apply, just the substantive portions. Jeff or Jill, did you want to add to that? No, good.
As I reach for my mute button, yeah, I just wanted to support that. Yeah, those ARARs are identified when the record of decision process, when the record of decision is put together. And so that's a discussion and a process that's done through the CERCLA process. So by the time that's finished, those ARARs are identified.
And that's applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. Sorry, acronyms.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy.
All right. We did have a question that came in earlier as well about indoor air pathways in occupied buildings. One of the attendees noted that the federal facilities program does not involve controls to mitigate possible complete indoor air pathways for future occupied buildings, that they only look at the existing occupied buildings. And they were just curious as to why it isn't a reasonable anticipation or anticipated reuse for occupied buildings to be constructed in the future, regardless of your residential or industrial end use.
I could take this one. I don't agree with the question. I think we do incorporate that into our institutional controls. If it's an area where we think that is going to be building, we'll put a RAO or a action of institution control action objective to state that if there is going to build, then they have to do some mitigation to see if we don't know if it is a pathway. So we can say that it is going to be, but we can put language in the land use control language if there is going to be building, that they have to investigate to see if it is a pathway. And if it is a pathway, then it has to be mitigated either through either through remediation or through a system and a building system to prevent human exposure.
Yeah,
So we do see that more now. Yeah. Yes, Amy.
sorry. I think the question also, Joe, I had some. I was not sure exactly what was meant. When you do your baseline risk assessment and you're looking at current risk, that's identifying if there is currently now, based on the land use that's happening now, an unacceptable risk that would trigger the need for a response action, a remedial action in that case, versus looking at future anticipated land use. Which is slightly different. So I'm not sure if there was just an overlap in those current baseline risk assessment for human health versus remedial action objectives and looking at future land use. So there might be a little bit of confusion with that, unless I'm misreading the question.
Okay. All right. I don't see any other questions in the queue, but I just want to be sure because we have time with our fabulous instructors. That there aren't any other coming in. So if you are a member of the audience and you have no additional questions for the speakers, go ahead and say no questions. Put no questions in the Q&A. That's helpful to know that we have met all of your needs. And if you're in the midst of writing an answer, go ahead and carry on. For those of you that might be getting ready to ask, well, wait, what's this about a series or how do I get credit or what about a certificate or wait, how, what? We're going to cover all of that before we close out today. If you have questions about how to get to the materials, we're going to cover that before we close out today. So I'm looking for any content or topic related questions. And without a doubt, I see no additional questions is the most common thing in the queue other than thanks for our speakers. So Emmy, I know you've got your contact info here on the slide. I'll let you share some final thoughts. We'll take a quick look to see if any other questions sneak in, and then we might start our closeout a little early today.
All right. Well, thank you everyone again for joining us for our first webinar offering for 2024 as part of the Federal Facilities Academy. As Jean mentioned, she'll take you through receiving credit for this course, as well as if you want to receive credit for the entire 12 courses to receive an Academy Certificate of Completion. But thank you again also to our instructors, Jill and Jeff. Thank you for sharing your expertise on today's webinar, and we look forward to seeing you all at the next one.
Oh, thank you so much, Emmy. All right, I'm going to go ahead and swap out a view and call up some quick final slides before we close out today. So I will just echo Emmy's thanks to all of the presenters, the organizers, the support staff, and the nearly 130 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. If you weren't here in the beginning, I'm going to just provide a few quick reminders about this overarching series called the Federal Facilities Academy that will be taking place over the next year. There will be a series of 11 webinars that we'll host live here through the Cleanup Information Network. Today was the first one. We'll carry on March 21st. 1st with another Federal Facilities Academy webinar. That session will look at community involvement at federal facilities. So each month we'll focus on a different topic. Each of these webinars will be recorded and archived, so you may register to take them live or you may watch the recorded version. You can receive participation certificates for each webinar, but if you're able to do all 11 webinars, and you qualify to take a classroom training delivery that will be a 3-day course open to federal regulators, states, tribal governments. If you're able to take and can complete that class, if you do everything that's online and that in-person 3-day classroom opportunity, you can receive a special academy certificate. So just to reinforce or visualize that, again, you can take the 11 webinars that are online open to the public. You can either take them live online or replay the archive. And then if you are a federal regulator, state regulator, or tribal representative, you may take the in-person classroom training. It's a 3-day course. And if you're that one, you can only take in person. And then you can get participation certificates for any of the online sessions that you take, whether you take them live or watch a recorded version. And if you're able to do all of the online classes, whether all online, live, all recorded, or some combination of that, and then you also qualify and can take the in-person classroom training, you can receive an academy certificate, noting that you've completed the entire series of courses. There is a flyer which highlights that and a URL on our Training Exchange website, which I will place in the chat, that will show you where you can find the complete suite of courses in this series and has points of contact and additional information. So I'm going to drop that in the meeting chat now. But with that overview of all of the sessions, let me walk through just a few final reminders for today's session. So first, I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org. We do list information related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. I also send out a free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, on the first of each month. We currently have about 43,000 subscribers from all over the world, and we're always looking to add more. If you'd like to be alerted as soon as free online training opportunities like today's webinar are available, we will list those in Tech Direct. So I encourage you to sign up for that free monthly newsletter. If you have any problems signing up or subscribing to the newsletter, you can send an email to me directly at ballant.gene@epa.gov, and I'll be happy to manually add you to our listserv. At the very start of the session, we highlighted that there is a unique seminar homepage. It's that same URL that I placed in the chat, shown in red on this slide. On that seminar homepage, we have a whole collection of information sections related to our class, including information about our speakers and their contact info, links to download what we call the participant manual, which includes not only the slides, but very detailed notes and links to resources. So I encourage you to download the participant manual for today's session if you haven't. And then we've also included a link to that flyer that highlights all of the courses in the Federal Facilities Academy. And then there are individual links to many of the guidance documents, the mappers, the tools, the example sites, the videos, the awards. All of those links, again, are found in a section on related links here. What's also here is a section for our online feedback form, and we do encourage you to share your thoughts on today's session. So for those of you looking for a participation certificate based on attending today's live broadcast, I encourage you to go to the seminar homepage, scroll down to that seminar feedback form, fill out the feedback form, making sure you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire session. And as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll then have access to a participation certificate that you can print out or save for your own records. If you happen to host a viewing party at your location and there were other individuals who joined and watched with you at your connection, but they didn't register on their own, please share the link to the seminar feedback form. They can each go there. They can fill it out on their own and get their own participation certificate, even though they didn't register on their own. And today's session was recorded and will be archived publicly on the CLUIN page, so anybody can come back and replay the session. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people watching the recorded version of this webinar, right about now in the archive above my head in the upper right corner, there will be a button that will take you to that seminar homepage and straight to the feedback form. You can still share your feedback, making sure that you check the box certifying you watched the entire archive, and then you'll still get a certificate based on your replay of the archive session. Usually takes us about 1 week or so to get those archives posted. So look for a follow-up email, which will point you to this homepage and to the feedback form so you can share your thoughts and get a certificate. So again, this is the first of a series. Hopefully you'll come back in March when we carry on and you'll join us on a future session. And with that, I want to again thank all of the instructors, all of the support staff in the background, and each of you for joining us live in today's session. We hope that you'll join us on a future CLUIN webinar. And with that, I'll formally conclude today's live broadcast.